Welcome to Book Choice on Fine Music Radio. My name is Paige Nick, and I'll be your host for today's show, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. We're bringing you today an hour-long show full of book reviews and author interviews. Today's show is all about the big names. We've got Dion Meyer, John le Carré, Alan Hollinghurst, L. Ron Hubbard, Mozart, Capitec, Esther Mhlangu, household names in crime fiction, action fiction, literary fiction, science fiction, music nonfiction, banking nonfiction, and art nonfiction. So let's get on with the show. We've got too much to bring you to spend any more time talking about it. We're going to go straight into it. We're starting out with author and reviewer Beverly Roos Miller, who's here to talk about a big South African heavy hitter. Dion Meyer is back with a new novel, came out at the end of last year. It's called Leo. It's a fantastic read. It's a thriller of note. And Beverly Roos Miller is here to give us a review.
Dion Meyer's massive international sales show that the South African author has cracked the crime market in a way that no other local has done. His latest thriller is Leo, which I grabbed with joy over the holidays and was not disappointed. I just come out of reading some very dark books, heavy fiction and non-fiction, so Leo was such a welcome break from all the gloom and doom. Not that there isn't some scary stuff in this, his latest Benny Gristle book, but at least I could pretend it was fiction. Well, mostly. Also, Meyer is quite a wry and witty writer, and while this wasn't as side-splitting as, say, his The Dark Flood, in which he hilariously describes Stellenbosch as being Volvoville, Leo has its breakout lighter moments. Benny's close colleague and friend, Vaughan Cupido, is, as usual, trying to lose weight even as they chomp on the job while in pursuit of the baddies. And angst-ridden Benny Grissel is trying very unsuccessfully to prepare for his imminent marriage, while solving these several mystifying yet interlinked major crimes. Plenty of very thinly disguised political figures crop up, but let's start near the beginning. A young woman is found dead by a local runner high up on the slopes of Stellenbosch Mountain. Her body lies near her mountain bike, with puzzling scratches or bites on her legs. There seems to be no reason for her death, other than a biking accident. But Benny isn't convinced, nor does he think it's a leopard attack, as the nervous young student who found her body assumes. They look like, well, dog bites. Meanwhile, a sultry female game ranger who's faked her credentials tells tourists not to run away from lions, presumably a reference to the Leo in the title, but to stand up to them and make a lot of noise to intimidate them. Just a note to our listeners, don't take this lion advice as a given. Lions will eat you if they're hungry or with cubs. Otherwise, like all cats, they couldn't be bothered, but best keep a very healthy distance. Connected to her is a sting to steal millions of dollars. A small group of experienced buddies carry grievances and a lot of firepower. The plan doesn't go well, and their resulting decision to steal yet more money from the same source of wealth sets off a trail of mayhem. Intertwined through all these doings are trails that lead to a former ex-president of South Africa. Let's call him President Zaka, and his cozy financial relationship with three Indian brothers. The story pivots from Bloemfontein to the dull dorp of Langsburg to a silent Russian ship docked in Simonstown, carrying who knows what cargo for who knows what reason, and no doubt a big profit. Towards the end of this quite long book, the Chinese, Indian, Russian, South African connections and the hunt for the money turns into a race against time, as Meyer cleverly shortens his chapters to speed up the pace. I'm not going to even pretend I could clearly follow the plot, which by now had thickened considerably. Does Benny make it to the church on time? By then you won't really care much. The riotous journey along the way is the whole point of Dion Meyer's latest winner.
That was New York, New York by Debbie. And you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick. And we've got our regular show where we bring you lots of beautiful book reviews, and we've got two big author interviews. We've got so much content today that I don't have a lot of time to talk about it. I want to get right into it. We're starting off with a review by Vanessa Levenstein of a John Le Carré novel. So Le Carré died in 2020. So no, it wasn't written by his ghost. But this novel, Carla's Choice, was written by Nick Harkaway, who's Le Carré's son. The family links here could be a spy novel all of its own. So this comes from the master of espionage and the second master of espionage, his son. Welcome to the show, Vanessa Levenstein. Tell us all about Carla's Choice, a John Le Carré novel by Nick Harkaway.
Described as a faked-up follow-up by a very esteemed Book Choice colleague, Carla's Choice was handed to me with the words, "Keep it. I don't want it back." It's written by Nick Harkaway, the son of David Cornwell, best known by his pseudonym John Le Carré. I happily bagged the book with no intention to review it. After all, to offer an educated opinion, surely you need to be able to spot the difference between the father and son. Smiley was soaked to the skin, and God, as a punishment, had removed all taxis from the face of London. That's Le Carré. He'd argued with taxi drivers, helped strangers with shopping, given directions, and in general allowed himself to be known and notable in the ordinary passages of life. And that's Harkaway. Nick Harkaway himself was only too aware that readers would love or hate the book. Which reminded me, a work of art or fiction is for everyone. There's a place for experts who are completely justified in not liking this book. And also for someone like me, who has read with both difficulty and appreciation Le Carré, but actually I prefer a Mick Herron, the author whose wonderful Slow Horses spy series are influenced by Le Carré. And if you're completely new to Le Carré, this book is also for you, as it works as a standalone. Carla's Choice is sandwiched between the spy who came in from the cold and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. George Smiley has been summoned from retirement to help the circus, think MI5, for a 48-hour assignment. Of course, there's no such thing as a quick fix in the land of spy, Soviets, and Smiley. George is reluctant to agree. His marriage is in a good space, and he is almost happy with his life. But when Control, the head of the circus, calls, you come. Smiley's job is to interview a young Hungarian girl, Susanna. She alerted them to the disappearance of her boss, Panati, who turns out to be a Soviet operative named Rorka. Their journey takes them from London to Vienna, where we see Smiley in true form. It seemed to Lake that crisis merely deepened Smiley's calm. And then it gets really exciting when they skip off to East Germany. One gets under the skin of these characters. We even get a sniff into the life of Carla, a Soviet operative and Smiley's nemesis, whose name only appears two-thirds into the novel, yet his presence lingers with an unease throughout. How is he linked? And who and where is he? It is the personal playing out against the backdrop of the Cold War that adds to the tension, the unpredictability, and the outcome. The bonds with those we love, especially parental, run from the Thames to the Danube. Rocco is desperate to find his missing son Leo, and Suzanne's loyalty to Rocco is that of a daughter. We learn about Carla's surrogate father, and it is this disquiet friction, the loyalty to one's loved ones tugging against the loyalty to one's country, that forwards the plot. We know, as does Carla, that Smiley's soft spot is his wife Anne. And here Harkaway offers a more empathetic portrait of Smiley's flighty, flirty wife. She justifies her affairs by equating them with Smiley's grey mistress, his work. Maybe this is how it is for us, you and your grey mistress, and me and my pretty boys, two respectable other loves within a marriage. Whether this novel does justice to the master of espionage is for you to decide. In the author's note, Harkaway writes, "It must hold you and leave you wanting more. Let's see if it does." And for me, it does just that. An exciting plot, believable characters, humor, and the spy who didn't come back from the cold, but rather was passed from father to son, our beloved George Smiley.
Thank you so much, Vanessa. That sounds really espionage-y and something you can really dig your teeth into. A good mystery. So we've had crime fiction, and we've had espionage fiction, and now we're going to have a little bit of literary fiction. Melvin Minow is here to talk about the latest by Alan Hollinghurst. It's called Our Evenings. When Hollinghurst brings out a novel, the literary fiction world sits up and takes notice. He's one of the big household names in literary fiction writing. And if he's up your alley, then I think this review is going to be up your alley. Tell us all about Our Evenings by Alan Hollinghurst, Melvin Minow. I suspect this year this will be up for some of the awards.
With his latest novel, Our Evenings, Alan Hollinghurst, who has just received a knighthood from King Charles, stakes his claim as one of the most stylish and accomplished descendants in the great Jamesian tradition of English storytelling, holding precise control of his characters' inner lives as finely observed social surroundings pave their destiny, in which we, entranced readers, find an irresistible, compelling narrative. Ever since that enigmatically named 1988 novel, The Swimming Pool Library, Hollinghurst's confidence in the so-called gay space of contemporary literature has been anchored and executed in the most elegant craft of words and sentences. The Booker Prize-winning The Line of Beauty's poetic title confirmed the masterly manner in which he sculptures a riveting telling in a language that frequently surprises in its tingle. Often a delicate balance of cheer and sadness charges his stories. His people are all too true, the ordinary and the odd. I venture to say Our Evenings is Hollinghurst's finest novel and puts him among the great novelists of our time. And I'm not alone in this acclaim. His knack of colouring in the ambiance of the era and his character's response to that social, political and economic settings provides heft to the actions and reactions of the people he so cleverly evoked to life. Like the previous novels, the historic context configures the plot. Our Evenings is the story of Dave Wynne, who narrates his life over six decades in his late middle age. Starting as a boy in the 60s, moving through the Thatcher years and concluding towards the time of the pandemic, it's a life that unfolds in fulfillment of artistic, social, political and sensual desire. From a bullied, quite not white boy to the acclaimed alternative actor, he traces a beautiful biography filled with beautifully painted characters. The main one is no doubt his mother Avril, a dressmaker, erstwhile wife of a husband left behind. She's the classic single mom providing care and comfort against all odds for the bright boy. It's a warm relationship, wonderfully drawn, so much alive, sustained throughout as the special link between mother and gay son. A meeting with another woman, a divorcee, connects her with a different relationship of sustenance. The delicacy with which Hollinghurst handles this, the discretion imposed by the time and place, and the son's budding sexuality is pure craft, treading lightly through the sensual and the sexual, avoiding the banal traps and allowing the reader to fill in the living spaces. The Dave Wynne character is one for the books. The classic British actor of the era, gay, sharply skilled, talented, not immune to acknowledgement, and yet adventurous in the arts of theatre and life. If a gentle streak of melancholy runs through his life, humour is never far. The sensitive life of an actor, ever in survival mode and yet daringly creative, is superbly portrayed. Wynne would be one of many. His antagonist is Giles, the rich schoolmate, whose kindly parents facilitate his education at school. This seemingly straight mate is a bully and later a loudmouthed conservative minister. Painted against the unfolding of gay liberation, class and race politics, Hollinghurst's sympathetic depiction of the main characters, the walk-ons and the small and larger dramas of their lives, cannot but find deep emotional resonance with readers. One of Sir Alan Hollinghurst's imposing achievements is how the elegance of his writing explores specific social spaces, map out gay realities with moral conscience, and like all good art, unveils the paradoxical paradigm comprising the human condition's strengths and frailty. Published by Picador, Our Evenings, with its ringing title, resonates with me as one of the best reads of the past few months.
Thank you so much, Melvin Minow, for joining us to tell us about Our Evenings by Alan Hollinghurst. Now we go from literary fiction into speculative fiction, or science fiction, as they call it. Rachel van der Pfeiffer is up next, and Rachel is regularly our young adult reviewer, but today she's got something slightly different, because this is an adult book. And it's from Writers of the Future. In fact, L. Ron Hubbard presents Writers of the Future. It says in the blurb that it's 15 illustrated short stories, plus this book contains art and writing tips, and it's edited by Jody Lynn. Welcome to the show, Rachel van der Pfeiffer. Tell us about Writers of the Future.
Writers of the Future is a yearly sci-fi and fantasy short story anthology and writing competition. The 40th volume was published at the end of last year and contains 12 short stories, each one illustrated by a winner of the companion competition, Illustrators of the Future. The collection includes a wonderful variety of stories. They range from the slightly creepy, including one about a nursing home where people's imaginary friends come alive, to the humorous and silly, including one involving a sentient toaster named Bredna. It also includes several bonus stories from established speculative fiction authors. The Writers of the Future competition was established in the 80s by prolific science fiction author L. Ron Hubbard. Many people may recognize him as the founder of Scientology, however, the competition has no connection to it. It is judged by leading science fiction and fantasy authors, including Orson Scott Card and Brandon Sanderson. Many new authors have launched their writing careers through this competition. I mostly review young adult fiction, so I do want to mention that Writers of the Future is adult fiction. However, most of the stories are suited to all ages, and all sci-fi fans will be able to find something to enjoy within. I also think it'd be a great avenue into the genre for new speculative fiction readers. The Writers of the Future anthology is published by Galaxy Press.
That track was In the Mood by Rocco DeVilliers, and you are tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. I know we're going quite quickly today because we've got a lot of content. So if you miss any of the titles or authors that we mention on today's show and you'd like to have a listen back, or if you enjoyed any of the reviews and you'd like to listen to them, or if you'd like to say to a mate, hey, I listened to a great show on Fine Music Radio, I want to let you know that we load this show as a podcast on the FMR website straight after the show. So you can click through to podcasts, find the show, you can download it or you can stream it from the website and you can have a listen to the show in your leisure. You can scrub through and find the review that you're interested, or You can just email us at Fine Music Radio with any questions you have, and we can let you know what you missed. Also, do let us know what you're reading. We love to hear what people are reading. It's one of our favorite subjects. So that was In the Mood by Rocco DeVilliers, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and we're getting into our next segment of the show. We're turning now to a little bit of nonfiction before we get to our interviews at the end of the show. We've got two of those. And getting the nonfiction part of the show going is Shirley Guler. She's talking about a book called Meetings with Mozart, which is by William Charlton Perkins. We thought you would all be interested in this. I'm sure there are lots of Mozart fans tuning in and listening to the show. So often when we see a title, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, that's a bit about music, we definitely want to bring that to your attention. So Shirley Guler, what would you like to bring to our attention about this book, Meetings with Mozart?
It's ambitious and original. This novel about a diversity of Durbanites who form the Society for the August Veneration of Mozart. William Charlton Perkins, in his Meetings with Mozart, clearly knows and has researched a great deal about the life and times of the boy Wonder, who is the absolute hero of this society. What started for me as an easy read became a very long one because I became captivated by mention of Mozart's music, some of which was new to me, but some of which, too much of which, took me to YouTube. Who knew the overture to Mitridate, Re di Ponte, an astonishing triumph of an opera Mozart wrote when he was 17, was so charming? I was sidetracked by odd arias or by harking back to Peter Schaeffer's Amadeus, hearing so clearly Salieri's words about the Gran Partita, which he compared to a rusty squeeze box. Then suddenly, high above it, an oboe, a single note hanging there unwavering, till the clarinet took over and sweetened it into a phrase of such delight. This was no composition by a performing monkey. It seemed to me that I was hearing the very voice of God, and that, I think, is what these august members were hearing, too. I was also beguiled by some of the Haydn string quartets Mozart penned. Then, of course, I went completely off the rails when Charlton Perkins mentioned Victor Borger and his imitation of the horns in a discussion of Mozart's horn concertos. I failed to find that imitation, but rediscovered the Happy Birthday variations and much more. Read the book, listen, and you will end up like me. But I digress. The book was indeed deeply rewarding on that count, but it was also rewarding on other counts. It's an introduction to a newbie to the world of Mozart, a life that was cut short when the impecunious and complex genius was just 35. And it's about his brilliance and his life itself told from two angles. First, there are short presentations by one or more of the members of the society who are bonded by their regard for classical music and who cover all of several genders, young and old, almost all races, from its retired theater director to an opera singer, exotic dancer, a carpenter, an alternative health expert, social weavers, and so on. Some of whom have their own ghosts, often including troubled relationships with parents. The overarching theme, apart from Mozart, is a shared warmth, togetherness, and even love in parallel universes and sketches. The second angle comes after each presentation when the director stages, in his mind, a theatrical representation of that evening's discussion. So you get to know a little more about Leopold and players like Empress Maria Theresa or Constanze, who come much more to life but leave you wanting more. I would like to have delved more into the character and history of the director. He is definitely worth exploring. It's also a sort of travelogue with a visit to the KZN Midlands, another to the Drakensberg, and still another up to the game parts of Zululand, and you can smell the fragrances of the Durban Nights. This book is only available in digital format from most of the recognized sellers overseas, but if you battle to buy it, consult the author's website, WilliamCharltonPerkins.com. I'll say it again. It's one word, WilliamCharltonPerkins.com.
Thank you so much, Shirley. That was Meetings with Mozart by William Charlton Perkins. As Shirley mentioned, we don't usually bring you books that aren't readily available in bookstores or online, but this title interested us. And as I said in the beginning, we know there are lots of Mozart fans listening to the radio station, so we thought we wanted to bring this to you. So if you're interested, do take a look. The author's name again is William Charlton Perkins, and you should be able to buy this title online. Right, so that was our music nonfiction, and now we get into a little bit of banking. So what does banking have to do with books and with fine music? Well, Twangi Kulula is here. and he's chatting about a new book that's out. It's called Capitec, Stalking Giants. It's by TJ Stradham. So Capitec interests me. For my other day job, other than hosting this show, which is such a great joy, I work in advertising and I do a lot of work on the big five banks in our country. I worked on all of them. And so I'm very interested, not just when I see a bank that has an epic rise to success, but any South African brand or company that changes a category and challenges a category really interests me. And that's something that Capitec has done really, really well. Nobody predicted that they would be quite as successful as they've been. The other thing that really interests me about Capitec is that they're a brand that has really pushed other banks in our country to do better. It's very difficult for a bank to bring out a new product or something different. Banks in our country, same as airlines, they're pretty standardized. So when there's some kind of upstart or some kind of young company that gets going in our country and succeeds, they really do challenge the other brands in our country to try harder and do better. And I think that's one of the great beauties of Capitec. They have taken our industry further, and I think that's a big deal. Twanji Kalula, I'm looking forward to your review of Capitec, Stalking Giants by TJ Stradham.
We are all familiar with banks, and in his latest book, Capitec, Stalking Giants, business journalist TJ Stradham reminds us just how relatable banks are from the dedication page. He dedicates the book to his parents, who opened a savings account for him at the post office in the 1980s. Now, many of us can remember the joy of opening our first bank accounts, but if you were born before the year 2000, it's unlikely that you would have opened your first account at Capitec, simply because the bank didn't exist. Today, the bank is well entrenched in our minds, but it is still somewhat of a relative infant when you consider the traditional banks that have been household names for decades, and these banks were established over a century ago. Given their rapid rise, Capitec is also one of South Africa's first major business success stories of the 21st century. Now, you may recall that the author TJ Stradham joined us on Book Choice 2 years ago to talk about his unauthorized biography of Koos Bekker. During that interview, it became clear to me that TJ is fascinated by how great businesses are made, and he's interested in how Stellenbosch's elite have built their empires. And he also loves sharing business success stories. And this book continues in the same vein. Capitec successfully did what all new businesses that go on to become household names do. It identified an unmet need in the market, and then it decided to meet it. At the dawn of democracy, most of the economically active population did not make use of traditional banking, and they were ignored by the traditional banks who didn't see the unbanked as a lucrative potential market. This meant that most of the population had limited access to affordable credit, the inability to earn interest on their savings deposits, and were limited to transacting in cash. Armed with extensive knowledge of the so-called mass market from their careers in the alcohol, lending, and banking industries, the founders of Capitec decided to take the time to truly understand their mostly black, lower-income consumers and provide a simple, modernized offering, something the large banks weren't doing at the time. What is even more interesting to me is how a group of men based in Stellenbosch's Technopark were able to make inroads into the smallest rural towns, leveraging their existing networks of microloan businesses, which were often seen as unscrupulous loan sharks at the time, and evolve them into an affordable, trusted, efficient banking system. Now, this book does a great job of introducing us to the entrepreneurs, men like Michael Leroux and Rian Stassen, who conceptualized, built, and marketed Capitec to millions of South Africans. They've been handsomely rewarded for their efforts. Today, the bank has over 23 million clients and 850 branches. It has also become one of the best performing companies listed on the JSE. And if you bought in when it first listed, you would be smiling today. But as always, TJ's books are extremely well researched. He wades through tons of material so that as readers, we don't have to. I find his storytelling easy to follow, and he manages to make dull concepts like government legislation around credit acts relatable and interesting. But of course, it's an unauthorized biography of the business, and he did not set out with the intention to expose any hidden scandals or show us where the bodies are buried. So if you're into books that are like that, you may be a bit disappointed. That said, it's a feel-good story to read at the start of the new year. It is filled with fascinating insights and feels like a masterclass in understanding how retail banking evolved over the last 3 decades in South Africa. Through Capitec, TJ Stratum highlights the roles that remaining focused, exercising discipline, and truly understanding your clients play in creating a successful business. Considering the subject matter, it turns out to be quite a light but informative read, so it gets a yes from me. Capitec, Stalking Giants by TJ Stratum was published by Tafelberg and retails for 330 Rand.
So wonderful to feel alive. That's right, I need to tell the world about it. Listen, here I feel it. Right there on Lewis Drive.
That was On Lewis Drive by Track 5, and you're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio with me, your host, Paige Nick, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. Our show today was pulled together by Mzuma Kesa. He's the man with the voice. He selects our music. He also pulls all our pieces together and makes us sound a little more impressive than we really are, hopefully. Thank you for everything you do, Mzu, and welcome back. Mzu's been on leave, so this is his first show back. I hope you're feeling rested and you had a great break. We've got our first of two big author interviews coming up now. The first, Beryl Eichenberger, takes us through this journey. She was chatting to a journalist in South Africa who's brought out a book called Below Luck Level. That journalist's name is Barbara Erasmus. Welcome to the show, Beryl Eichenberger and Barbara Erasmus.
I had the privilege of meeting Barbara Erasmus back in the early 2000s when I was involved in book events focusing on South African women authors. It was a time when many locals did not read local authors, the perception being that they were all writing about politics and apartheid. Barbara's early novels, Kaleidoscope and Even with Insects, had little to do with politics and much to do with life, believable characters, behavior, families, relationships, and mental health. Easy reads laced with dry humor. Erasmus writes with a light hand on issues that often remain unspoken, always with empathy but haunting, which possibly explains why, after all these years, I can still feel the stories. Below Luck Level is her fourth novel. Published in 2012 by Penguin, it only came to my notice when Catalyst Press launched it to the North American market in 2024, testament to its topicality and longevity. It's a delight to be able to introduce this story at a time when awareness of mental health, particularly as we age, is prominent. Perhaps I might read the poetry extract that opens the book. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. That's by Kay Ryan.
Yes.
And it's my delight to welcome Barbara Erasmus into the studio. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
It's been a while.
It's been a while.
There's so much in this story, and while it deals with Alzheimer's, there are the issues of mothering, friendship, and the right to die. So just taking a step back, there is a trend in your narratives to address mental challenges. Why is that?
Well, I'm a journalist, and so my interest is in topical issues. And you cannot get a more topical issue than Alzheimer's. It was published in the USA now, where over 7 million people are suffering from the disease. And the cost of caring for them is now included every year in the national budget.
Good heavens.
Yes, it's a very, very big issue. And novels about Alzheimer's are about as prolific as novels, as South African novels about apartheid used to be.
Yes.
So the challenge for me in writing this novel was to try and think of a different slant. And the topic is at odds with my usual writing style, which is light. The topic,
and yet you kept it humorous.
Well, yes, the topic is bleak, but my goal was to write an entertaining novel about Alzheimer's.
Well, definitely entertaining, and I certainly loved the character. So don't you want to give us a little short synopsis in your own words?
Yes, well, it's a character-driven story about a mother and a daughter relationship. And the mother, Chloe Cartwright, is a prize-winning author who wrote those novels about apartheid we all had to plow through in matric. Her daughter, Hannah, is not much good at anything. Claim to fame is shoplifting.
Why? Why the shoplifting?
When you look up shoplifting on Google, it's described as an impulse disorder. And Hannah's kleptomania is very much related to her dysfunction with her body image.
Right.
She, all the things she steals are too small for her. She steals ballet shoes when it becomes obvious that she'd do better in a rugby team.
Yeah.
And so I found that was a good way to try and develop her character.
And Chloe, I mean, she's quite mad, was a terrible mother. So that shift for Hannah to suddenly see these peculiar things happening and not really notice them to begin with, because she didn't want to notice them, I think, but then realize that this is the beginning of Alzheimer's and have that affirmed. But Hannah has to become the mother, and she becomes a very empathetic mother.
Yes, I feel that their relationship was not good initially.
No.
Because her mother didn't want, her friends used to say her mother was like her best friend.
Yeah.
And Hannah didn't want a best friend. She wanted a mother.
Right.
Someone who would look after her. And that's not something she got in her childhood. She and her brother grew up very much on their own devices. And the relationship with her brother, still, he's now immigrated, which is very much another factor, which is common to South African audiences. Families live overseas. And so all the responsibility for caring for her mother falls on Hannah, and she has to shoulder that.
But she wants her mother to have dignity, and I think that's, and we're going to have to end off very shortly, but I think what's important in this novel is that you deal with the right to die and the rather humorous way they go about it in terms of visiting Switzerland and the rest.
Yes, the point is that South Africa has one of the most enlightened constitutions in the world, but it denies its citizens a right that's afforded to its dogs.
Exactly.
Hannah wants her mother to die like a dog.
But the nicest possible
like
way.
Like a beloved, cherished dog beside a professional who will give a dose to make the ending come more quickly. And even the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland, which is where they go, is not able to offer a solution. No. I liked the Anne Ryan poem that you quoted, which mentions a lottery, because Hannah initially wins a small prize on the lottery, and it is that money that she uses to cover the airfares to go to the Dignitas
Clinic. And that's a wonderful cliffhanger to actually end on. Barbara, thank you so much for coming in today. The book is Below Luck Level by Barbara Erasmus. It's published by Catalyst Press and available in stores now. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it. Good. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
Darling, it's wonderful to be in love with you.
That was Darling, It's Wonderful by Virginia Lee, and I hope you're finding, darling, that this show is wonderful. My name is Paige Nick. You're tuned into Book Choice on Fine Music Radio, and our show is sponsored by Exclusive Books. We're heading to our very last segment now. We have another big author interview. This is a co-author interview. Philip Todres is the man wielding the microphone, and he's chatting to an author whose name is Thomas Grist. And he collaborated with Azun Wagbogu and Hans Ulrich Obrist on a very important book. It's called To Paint Is in My Heart, and it's about Esther Mhlangu, who is a South African, I'm pretty sure I don't need to tell you this, she is a South African icon of the art world. It started way before the BMW art car, but that was one of those iconic pieces that I think sticks in all of our heads. I was lucky enough to go to the National Gallery and see her latest exhibition, which has now moved to Johannesburg and then will move globally. If it's near you and you have the ability to go and see it, I highly recommend it. It is a magnificent exhibition. Takes you very much into her mind and into her history and into her legacy. It's full of storytelling. There are so many stories. This struck me when I went to go see the exhibition. There are so many stories she shares about her travels, about how she got discovered, about her work, and she's just a powerhouse. So this is a fantastic interview that Philip got to do with Thomas Grist out of Berlin about To Paint Is In My Heart. Welcome to the show.
We'll be talking about Esther Mhlangu, To Paint Is In My Heart, a new book published by Thames and Hudson, and there are three authors, Thomas Grist, Azu Nwagbogo, and Hans Ulrich Obrist. And I'm very lucky to have with me one of the authors, Thomas Grist. Welcome, Thomas. And let's start about who you are, because I know you're involved with BMW and that particular association with Esther. So let's start there, how you got involved with this fantastic project.
Well, thank you for your interest in this amazing book that we're all very proud of having published. I'm an art historian by training, and I joined BMW to become their global head of cultural engagement in 2003. And ever since then, it's a great job. I've been working for BMW. And of course, you know, I was very much aware of the Art Car series and of Esther Mhlangu's role within that series. So I think she's been on my radar for the past 2 decades.
Okay. And funny enough, it should be this year, because there's that extraordinary exhibition that took place at Ezekiel South African National Gallery, and which is now in Johannesburg, and I believe will travel internationally. But again, we're fortunate that we did briefly say hello to each other at 195 at Somerset House in London, where there's enormous exposure. And that's where the book was launched. But let's start at the beginning. Who is she, and how do you believe that she's changed from being the traditional artist to become combining, as she says, the old and the new?
Well, what I really cherish about Esther Mhlangu is that she's a pioneer in what she's been doing and what she's been trying to achieve. I mean, we were fortunate enough, and I have no idea how that happened, to have her paint an art car, being the first African, the first female artist to be part of that series of the BMW art car series, in which, of course, Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein and Frank Stella and Alexander Calder came before. But what was of interest most to me in this moment in time, when she's in her late 80s, is that, you know, she's basically, to me, moving into the center of the contemporary art world, at least when it comes to the attention that she's getting, not only from collectors, from Beyoncé to Rihanna to Trevor Noah to Oprah Winfrey, but also when it comes to celebrating her and her achievement as an artist, as we've seen in the Central Pavilion of the Venice Biennial earlier this year, as we've seen with the huge mural that the Serpentine Gallery in London, one of the foremost contemporary institutions worldwide, with that commission of Esther Malango to present a mural, which also opened during the time of the Frieze Art Week in London earlier in October this year. It seems all is coming together to pay tribute and to honor and acknowledge Esther Mashlangu as an artist.
I should have mentioned, actually, that you were involved in the interview process with her and where you got to, you know, that one-on-one contact.
You know, to me, it was very important because, as I said at the beginning, and that's why we are sitting together here, is that I think books matter. You know, people reading books matters. Getting the word out matters. Being able to look at her work through pages of a book matters. Thames & Hudson is an amazing publisher, you know, in New York and in London. So it's guaranteed that there will be a worldwide distribution. It was great you mentioned the book launch, the 154 Art Fair in London earlier this year. The publisher already let us know that there will be a second edition because when they advertised this within the markets worldwide, there was a big pull in terms of those that wanted more books for the markets. So it will already, without having been published earlier this year in October when they made that announcement, there will already be a second edition. So I thought that it would be great to publish a book with her and not just art historical gibberish, which is important enough, but really in her own words, because I felt she has so many things to say and they're so potent for other artists, for those that want to be inspired by her, for those that want to learn more about the person behind her Ndebele-inspired art. It was important to me to get a book out with her own words. I thought it was great to appear during the time of the show that you have mentioned, the big retrospective that will then also travel internationally. And if you allow me also to get Azu Enwakbogu, you know, a great force for African contemporary art worldwide, as well as Hans-Ulrich Obrist, the director of the Serpentine Gallery involved, because those two are part of the most powerful people in the art world. And when I asked Hans-Ulrich Obrist about this project, whether, you know, he wanted to interview with me, Esther Malango, he said she was high up on his list of artists to interview. And we were happy to find a time in September 2023 to make that true and go to her for 2-3 days, you know, take the time, drive from Johannesburg for 3-4 hours and visit her and be able to interview her.
Now, it's extraordinary. And I think the most important thing to get across is if you buy the book, you also see an extraordinary range of her artwork. So it's not just about words, it's about visuals. Very, very powerful. And perhaps you just would like to say, as a parting comment, the subtitle is "To Paint is in My Heart." Just that when she started that young age of 10 years old, knowing that she had a story to tell, just something along those lines, perhaps?
Well, the way that she speaks about her art, there is a sense of urgency about this, you know, a sense of bringing beauty to the world. And I think that is such a great achievement. That art does not need a vocabulary that is being translated. When you are in front of a big mural, for example, in the center of London at the Serpentine, and you look together with other people that might be strangers at this mural, you feel a connection.
Well, that's the important point. I think the connection and the way you've actually put it down in that book is really extraordinary. We've been speaking to Thomas Gerst, and it's about the book Esther Mashlangu, To Paint is in My Heart. It's three authors, Thomas Gerst, Azu Enwakbogu, and Hans-Ulrich Obrist, and it is a book you'd want to read and enjoy and enjoy and enjoy looking at the wonderful visuals.
Thank you so much.
A big thank you to Philip Todras and to Thomas Gerst for that incredible interview. Having seen the exhibition, that actually gave me even more insight. So I'm so pleased that I got to hear about this and got to see all of it. And I would love to take a look at this book. I would imagine it's one of those books you keep forever and keep on your coffee table and you dip into it all the time. And that brings us to the end of our show. So I also want to thank all our reviewers, all our authors who've come on the show to be interviewed, and all the publishers who send us these wonderful books. You take us into another great year of reading. We're so excited to hit our reading challenges and to bring these books out to the public. And a reminder to you, if you've got any kind of big present you need to buy coming up, an anniversary present, a birthday present, and you're thinking, what do I buy this person, or what can I buy somebody who has everything? Person will always love a book, whether they're a child, whether they're an adult, whether they like speculative fiction, crime fiction, espionage fiction, art nonfiction, banking nonfiction. There has to be a book for everybody. So do remember that. Put it in the back of your mind. A book lasts forever, and it takes you into another world. So I wanted to tell you what I've been reading as well, but I'm going to start with a story. I had 2 hours of dental surgery yesterday, and I got to tell you, I laughed through most of it. And it wasn't due to happy gas. It was due to a book called Good Material, which is by Dolly Alderton. And then this morning I went for a run and I cried through some of my run. So that's how good this book is. It made me laugh, proper laugh, when I should have been crying at the dentist. And it made me cry, and I'm saying proper cry, actual tears, when I should have been laughing while I was running. The book is about Andy Dawson. He's a British bloke. He and his girlfriend, Jen, who've been together for 4 or 5 years, are going through a massive breakup. He's 35, so it's kind of that crucial life point where they probably, he would have wanted to carry on and get married to her, and that just didn't happen because she broke up with him, and he just can't figure out why she broke up with him. And he goes through this huge breakup. And he's so brokenhearted. And this author, Dolly Alderton, she really gets it right. How she got into the mind of a 35-year-old British bloke, he's a comedian, so it comes with all that humor. How she got into this bloke's mind so well is beyond me. She's done an astonishing job. This book was very recognizable to me. It reminds me of my last breakup, which just about broke me. I think it would remind all of us of that big breakup we've been through. It's very cleverly written. It's very funny. It's very sad, and it's very real. I highly, highly recommend it. If you've read that David Nichols book, it's called You Are Here, and you enjoyed that book, I think you'll enjoy this one too. Or even David Nichols' other big book was called One Day. If you enjoy that kind of genre, I can highly recommend it. Comedy, but it's not fluff. It's beautifully written. It'll have you laughing and crying and really enjoying it, and it'll make the time fly. That's Good Material by Dolly Alderton, and that's what I've been reading. We're going to play out with a song called Licorice by Nossa Vida, and we'll be back in 2 weeks' time with Book Choice Publisher's Choice. And until then, happy reading.